Time Blender, a novel by Star Trek's own Michael Dorn. Samurai warriors battle Egyptian gods in the Island of No Return. Also by Hilary Hemingway and Jeffrey P. Lindsay. Chapter 1. In the faint pre-dawn light, a figure moved on the clifftop. Outlined against the dim glow of the ocean, a man stood, strong but surprisingly graceful. His movements were slow, precise, and smooth.
Breathe in.
Breathe in.
Let the breath fill the center.
Fill the center.
Let the movement flow from the breath.
From the breath.
Dr. Tony Miller paused in the middle of his morning Tai Chi. Tall, hard-looking for an academic, black, and handsome, he wore his hair cropped short in the military style he found most convenient. He stood for a moment in a half-crouch, his arms pushed out to the right, holding the breath and waiting for his mind to clear again. The images had come back for a moment, but he was ready. He battled them calmly, clearing them with a breath. He was a tenured professor, some might say an unexciting man, but he was not a man who gave up, and never had been. He took another centering breath, pushed the pictures forcefully out of his head, and resumed.
Let the breath fill the chi. There is no thought. Only the breath.
Only the breath.
The chi.
The chi.
The movement.
The movement.
The movement.
Miller had been doing Tai Chi every morning for 3.5 years now. He had tried yoga but found it too passive. With work and concentration, the Tai Chi worked. He could clear his mind, refocus his energy, force the painful images out. He'd had a few bad months without sleep and had tried sleeping pills, herbal therapies, acupuncture, a little of everything. He had even considered a therapist, but the thought of it made him so uncomfortable he couldn't go through with it. So he'd hit on this, and the Tai Chi worked. Every time the images came to him.
The faces. The children's faces.
A deep, centering breath, a movement of concentration, and the faces were gone. He was sleeping normally again, had been for 2.5 years now. He liked to keep his life calm, waking and sleeping. Surprises were not for people with research grants. And he very definitely had a research grant. His career was on a rising track, and the research he was doing here might at least provide him with academic security beyond tenure. Maybe even a family. Life was good. Miller slid into a difficult series of movements. Sweat popped out on his forehead.
There is no thought.
There is no thought.
There is no
only
thought.
The breath.
Only the breath.
For the next 5 minutes, Miller moved through the exercise, and memory left him alone. The movements flowed perfectly now. His breathing was easy, controlled. He felt the energy flow through him, and for a good 5 minutes, he thought of nothing. Nothing at all. Finally, as he stood in the crane position looking over the ocean, the sun rose out of the water. Miller held his stance for a full minute, just watching the sun, happily aware of its warmth on his face, enjoying the feeling of being ready for work and free from the bad memories for another day. Miller let out a long breath, slowly straightened.
It's about time,
a voice said behind him. Miller whirled, dropping by reflex to a combat-ready crouch, hands coming up to fighting position. Dr. J. Cook chuckled.
Gotcha,
he said. Cook, a short, wiry, and caustic paleobotanist, was Miller's partner on this scholarly expedition. He stood holding 2 cups of coffee, extending one for Miller to take. Miller straightened.
I didn't hear you,
he said. Cook snorted.
You're not the only one who's delved into the mysteries of the Far East, Tony,
he said.
I can move quietly when I want to, you know. I had a year of ninjutsu training.
Miller took the coffee cup.
And a year of kung fu, and a year of tai chi, and before that, a year of wado karate, 3 months of yoga. Hell, Jay, you've tried everything, and you've never stuck to any of it long enough to get anything from it.
Except my marriage,
Cook said, making a bitter face.
Just long enough to get a kid, and to get broke.
He spit and sat on a rock.
Community property,
he said, with real bitterness.
I live in a section of town I tell my students to avoid. She lives in Marin, and I still have to pay her. Where's the logic of that, Miller? Where's the justice?
It's your kid, too,
Miller said, sipping his coffee. He liked Cook, appreciated the sharpness of his mind, the man's restless energy. But outside of academia, these qualities had not served him well. and Cook's personal life was a disaster. Although Miller hid it well, he had a bit of contempt for Cook's inability to make a marriage work, and his helplessness with, and seeming apathy toward, his son Jerry, who seemed like a pretty good kid. Part of the contempt, Miller knew, was jealousy. He had put off marriage and kids deliberately, first for military service, then for their tenure track, and now it was just another thought to push away, just for now, but he badly wanted kids someday. And that someday would be soon. Miller smiled. It would be soon. There was no more doubt. This research would put him far enough ahead of the game that he could relax for a while, look around, find somebody truly solid, and make a go of it. But could he change enough to make it work? Or would he end up like Cook, a poor excuse for an ex-husband and an absentee father? Because so far, his work had always come first. And it took him far away for long stretches of time. They had been here on Runa Puake Island for 3.5 months. Could he make a marriage work and still make these vital field expeditions? How many ball games or ballet recitals would he have to miss? Kids were damned important, yes, but his work was important too. Would he be able to find the balance? Cook never let those doubts into his mind. His passion was all for the work. Everything else was a pointless distraction, something that would interfere with the work if you let it. So he didn't. It was one reason they had been so successful in their separate careers and together here on the island. They both drove themselves harder and further than their colleagues. Miller sipped his coffee. A small, slow smile worked onto his face. Hell, he was beating himself up for neglecting an imaginary marriage, a child he didn't yet have.
What's so funny?
Cook demanded.
Nothing.
Don't tell me nothing, Tony. We've been nose to nose on this goddamned island for 13 weeks, and I've seen you smile exactly twice.
Your jokes are no good,
Miller said.
I don't tell jokes. I don't know any, and you wouldn't like them. So what the hell are you smiling at?
Berkeley,
Miller said.
What would happen to Dean Nagel if the ratio of population to resource reached critical like it did here?
They'd eat him,
Cook replied.
And I'd want to watch. Hell, I'd pay to watch. You surprise me, Tony. That's actually worth a smile.
And they'd put up a huge monument to small-minded paper shufflers on top of his bones,
Miller said.
A giant paper head,
Cook said.
Stamped, sealed, and signed in triplicate, stapled to a purchase order. And future generations will wonder why the Berkeleyans worked so hard to bring that precious paper all the way from the library.
Future generations will wonder what's for lunch,
Miller snorted.
And they'll write their names on the paper head.
Probably so,
Cook said, and they sipped quietly for a minute. Thinking of these things happening on campus was amusing, but here on this island it hadn't been funny at all. There was no real satisfaction in imagining some aboriginal Dean Nagel eaten by his minions. Because exactly that had happened here, on this once beautiful island some 1,200 miles west of Tahiti. The mystery of the wonderful stone heads and the disappearance of the islanders was solved, and it wasn't pretty. Looked at from Miller's distance in time and perspective, it had all been horrifyingly slow and inevitable. But after 3 months of careful digging, study, and generating computer models, there was no room for doubt. Miller and Cook now knew where the original inhabitants of the island had gone. They'd been eaten. By their neighbors, their friends, their families. A complex and beautiful paleo-civilization had evolved to the point where its enemies were eliminated. Population had grown, and then kept growing, expanding out of control, multiplying out of all reasonable bounds, until the island could no longer support even half as many. And as the population grew, it destroyed more and more of the ecosystem, annihilating all the fish and other food animals, destroying plant life, raising the forests, until there was nothing left to eat, except each other. A complex clan system had at first controlled and ritualized the cannibalism, but at some point even that control had broken down and it had become eat your buddy before he eats you. End of civilization. End of Runa Puake Island. And soon, end of eat your buddy. No more buddies left. A few islanders had probably survived somehow, probably by taking to their boats and heading blindly out to sea. But that was speculation, perhaps the subject of some future research. There was no life left on Runa Puake, beyond a few straggly strands of grass and a few insects. And for right now, they had the answers they'd come looking for. Miller felt a strange mix of triumph at the result of their work and horror for what they had found. The gnawed skeletons buried under the great stone heads, human teeth marks clearly visible, were deeply disturbing. But Miller had no illusions. He knew what humans were capable of, what he himself had done.
"Back to the salt mines,"
Cook said, standing and interrupting Miller's unwanted train of thought.
"My preliminary analysis indicates some highly unusual trace minerals."
"Well, have a nice residue,"
Miller said, toasting Cook with his coffee mug.
"I'll be down in a few minutes."
"See that you are,"
Cook said.
"I'll want another echo scan before too long."
He turned and headed off down the hill to their worksite. Miller turned back out to sea, watching the slow roll of the waves and the early morning sun reflecting off the water. He sipped slowly, quietly amused that he had actually come to like the nasty freeze-dried stuff. 4,000 miles from the nearest Starbucks, he didn't have much choice anyway. He was relaxing. It amazed him, but he could actually feel his shoulder muscles unknot, the perpetual stress draining out of him. After 3 months here, alone on an uninhabited and nearly uninhabitable island, away from the madness at Berkeley, he felt himself slowly coming back to the controls, in charge of his life again in a way he hadn't felt for years. No PC mad pencil pushers yanking his strings. No undereducated, unmotivated, whining, self-centered, "I deserve it" students pushing at his carefully controlled temper. Whether it lasted or faded as soon as they got back, it was worth the whole trip just to be himself again for a little while. But of course, just the thought, just thinking he had it beat, was enough to trigger the images. Miller stared out at the ocean, willing his mind to be blank. But the rolling sea changed. The waves became sand dunes. The dark of the water became the night sky. And he's racing above the desert under a moonless sky, leading his attack group at low altitude under the Iraqi radar ceiling. He's once again at the controls of his B-2. Even at this tremendous speed, he can see the damage the war has brought to this precious region, the cradle of civilization. The loss of irreplaceable antiquities, sites still unknown, treasures unguessed at, sickens him. But as a soldier, he also knows that the only way he can hope to protect any of it is by hitting the enemy, hitting him hard and fast and repeatedly, and ending the war as quickly as possible. And that's what this night sortie is all about. The plan is to simultaneously hit all the Iraqi control centers, hit with such devastating power and precision that Saddam will have no choice but to surrender. Miller does not like the choice, but he is a good soldier, and he knows it is the only choice.
"Target coming up. 60 clicks."
He hears the navigator's voice in his ear. The sky around him lights up like the 4th of July. It seems hard to believe that his plane has been spotted, but there is a great deal of anti-aircraft activity around them. And now he is very busy making all the last-minute preparations for dropping his 2,000-pound laser-guided missile. This is the most sophisticated member of its ancient family. It does not simply fall and blow up. No, it has an inboard computer that will guide it to its target, and a video camera in the nose to relay pictures back to his plane to confirm that it strikes its target. And then they are over the target. He releases the missile. The video screen shows its speed true to its mark, Saddam's communication center. And at the last second, he sees people in the windows, staring up in horror at the missiles homing in on them, staring and screaming. 10 years later, he can still see those faces. Children's faces. Saddam had packed the building with children. Whether to protect the building or to sacrifice the children on the altar of world opinion, it was impossible to say. But Miller could still see the faces, still feel the horror, still hear the clicking sound as his hand reflexively pulled at the firing switch, trying uselessly to call the missile back. What kind of man could do that? Sacrifice children like that? Rage blew through him, and his hands shook so badly he almost lost control of the aircraft. Had Saddam truly kept this a secret in order to spring it on the world press that the U.S. murdered innocent children? And then the worst questions of all had come. Had U.S. intelligence known? How could they know so much, give him such precise technical data for this raid, and not know about this? How could they know, or even suspect, and fail to scrub the mission? How could they not know? Combat flying was over for Miller that night. It had been his great love, the ultimate adrenaline high. After that night mission over Baghdad, he felt nothing but nausea every time he sat at the controls. The Air Force could no longer hold him. Instead, he He found himself powerfully drawn to history, to protecting the knowledge and relics of history. He became fascinated with the cultures of the past, working quickly and brilliantly through grad school and a doctorate, searching out the answers for how those cultures had survived and how they died. And somehow, here he was, 10 years later, a tenured professor at a major university, sitting on top of a cliff and trying not to see the faces anymore. The wounds had scabbed over. They were still there, under the surface, but they were slowly beginning to heal. He buried himself in his work, driving himself relentlessly. If he was tired enough, he wouldn't dream. And the Tai Chi helped too. The faces were still there, but not as often, and not as bad. And pretty soon, perhaps they would stop coming. Shaking the mood off, Miller took a deep breath and raised the coffee cup to his lips, and paused halfway. Far out over the ocean, in the shimmer of the early morning sun, something moved. What it was, he couldn't say, but there was something out of place about it. Something wrong. Miller stood, shading his eyes and looking hard, trying to make out some detail that would tell him what it was. It appeared to be moving closer. Soon, rising from the bright glare of the water, he could just barely make out a shape. Miller blinked, rubbed his eyes, and looked again. It was moving closer. And this time there was no doubt. The shape took a form, and he began to see the terrible expanse of it, and the conviction grew into certainty that he knew what it must be. Tsunami! Tidal wave! Miller turned and raced down the hill. End of chapter.